everybody. These are fun, man. These drives are fun.
It's see? It's Chick-fil-A.
It's old school stuff.
Chick-fil-A was our stop today, ladies and gents.
I don't know if it was Chris or somebody in the office last night said, man, you're going to take that long drive after being here to like 2 a.m.? I said, there's nothing to it, man. I mean, I've been doing this forever.
Yeah. Well, those guys have never been in a territory.
Yeah. Right. And that's where...
A lot of our guys in our team at AEW are having their first experience working for a real wrestling company.
Yeah. Don't you feel that? And I was right at the end of the territories. You know, I started in 83, and that's... Don't you feel that I learned so much about the business, man. I really feel fortunate that I was there during the territories, even though it was at the end.
Absolutely. Yeah. That's great for the education. I agree with that.
Yeah.
Everything. The car trips were classrooms.
Classrooms
on wheels.
Yeah.
And guys talk the business. And now they're on their phone. Texting.
That's right.
Tweeting. Instagramming.
Yep.
Whatever.
Right.
But some of those drives, in the 70s, when I first got in the business, in the mid-70s, you know, I learned early on that you can get a great education just by listening. Just, especially shut up and drive, kid. Shut up and drive and listen. So they didn't tell me that but once.
Only told me back in the old days that they used to get together, I don't know if, you know, not only in a car, but, you know, sit in a locker room or something afterwards and talk about the business for hours.
Yeah.
Just.
Well, you know, these guys are all, they're a combination of a lot of things, you know, but the one thing that they were in the territory days were entrepreneurs.
Yeah.
You know, until way late in my career, there weren't any contracts.
Oh no. I mean, 1099 or whatever it is, right?
Yeah. But there were no guarantees were few and far between.
You got hurt, you didn't get paid.
Right. The promoters had it. They'll say, well, we had all the risk. We had to rent the building, we had to buy the advertising, we had to, you know, provide you an opponent, blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
But quite frankly, pro wrestlers have settled for less than the best for years and years.
Yeah.
That's why when you got around with all those old timers, they would talk about a territory they were last in or the territory they were returning to or whatever. They had great reports on that stuff because that was the way they earned a living. And they wanted to work with the better promoters that would give them a fair count. You know, when you didn't have the era of the roll tickets, hard tickets,
mm-hmm.
Well, that's just somebody's word.
Yeah.
There's no verification. It led to mistrust. The payoff scenario, the formula to arrive at the payoffs were daunting at best. I remember the old formula used to be on payoffs for the live events was the main event generally got 3% of the net ticket sales after taxes. So in other words, if your net was $100,000 in the gate that night and you're in the main event, you're probably going to get paid somewhere around $3,000.
Okay.
3% of the net after taxes.
Yeah.
So they took the taxes off the top, paid the taxes, and that next number was the number that the payoffs were derived from. But again, you still got that trust issue. A, did we get the right count? The house not bigger?
Yeah.
You know, and B, formulaic way of getting the payoffs to somebody was also discretionary income. And so the promoters themselves created a system that was not trustworthy.
Yeah.
It bred this, you know, discontent, questions.
You know, the first time I heard about that was, I guess, 86, Great American Bash. You know, the Crocketts went all over with the stadium shows.
Yeah.
And I remember we worked Veterans Stadium in Philadelphia. It was one of our first ones. And I was there as, like, I don't even know what I was doing there, because back then, in Pennsylvania, you had to use the ring announcer, who was like the commission's ring announcer.
Yeah.
So I remember being there. I remember, and we had a great crowd. And I asked Elliot Murnick, who's no longer with us. I asked, you know, he's since passed away.
Yeah, I remember Elliot.
Yeah. I asked Elliot, I said, what was the house? And he told me the house. And I remember going down to the locker room, and the guys in the locker room had heard what the house was, and they couldn't believe it. They said, there's no way that this house is that low. You know, that way they were like bitching, you know, and so there was distrust then, you know. And Tully, who grew up in the business, you know, he was one of them that, you know, didn't trust numbers. He was very outspoken about that. And I never forget that Philadelphia count. And I remember looking at the house thinking, man, that's a lot of people. But I didn't have any way to gauge it. I didn't know. But there was a lot of unhappy guys that night.
You mean they didn't do any stadium shows in Craigsville?
No, they didn't do any stadiums in Craigsville.
Yeah, that's always been an issue. It's always been funny to me that, you know, the two most important elements of pro wrestling are talent and television.
Yeah.
You can't do one without the other.
Right.
You can't not have one and have a successful business. It won't work. So, to take care of your talent with some sort of guarantee, it's better now. I get that.
Yeah.
But still, growing up in the territory era, as we were talking about, you kind of get exposed to all this stuff.
Yeah. I just love it. I just love being a part of that business back. Well, of course, you know, I was a big fan. Just, you know, years prior to that when I started, but I just love being a part of that, having to do work based on house shows, and that was the bread and butter. And, you know, the guys worked all the time. Remember, Arn came in one day in the backstage, or back where we did the interviews, the local interviews. That was an all-day thing, man, those local interviews.
Wow.
All-day thing.
It was a huge deal, too, man.
Oh, man, it was.
That's how you sold tickets.
Sure.
And the only way you made money in that era was selling tickets.
Yeah.
It's funny, before pay-per-view and before organized merchandising,
yeah,
there was one source of income for wrestlers.
Yeah.
Ticket sales.
Ticket sales.
This is before pay-per-view, the whole nine yards. So the art of doing a extemporaneous promo with the express thought in mind to sell tickets was something everybody worked on every week. It was a skill set.
Yeah.
That's why guys that could really talk, the Cornettes of the world, for example, they were so valuable, because they could sell tickets. They could tell the story,
mm-hmm,
and weave in the town's name, the building, and
sure,
whatever.
Yeah.
That helped them do other promos.
Yeah.
Then we've gone through an era where a lot of WWE guys are just getting a script. Okay. So they're expected to memorize their lines and then go deliver it in a professional and effective fashion with literally no time to prepare.
Right.
It's just, you need to go by memory, just memorization. So I can tell you from experience that your biggest issue should be delivering a great promo, not remembering your lines.
Yeah.
Delivery, not memory. So that's why all the best, if we both know, they got a few bullet points, if they need the who, what, when, and where, I'll go, give me 2 minutes.
Sure. I started that year I spent in the WWE, I was 89, and that's when they had Saturday Night's Main Event. And when they would have a Saturday Night's Main Event taping during like a Challenge or Superstars taping, they would bring in the NBC people that they ever saw, and they would script out the interviews for Saturday Night's Main Event. But that was the only thing that was scripted back then. And I may be wrong, but maybe that was the beginning of Vince getting an idea to script those interviews.
Well, Vince was very influenced by Dick Eberson.
Yeah.
And if you needed a television role model, Eversole certainly wasn't a bad one to have.
No. I had a lot of time for Dick Eversole, man. Yeah. He and I got along quite well.
Good man.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was very close to this little boy that got killed in that plane crash.
Really?
Yeah.
That's terrible. That's horrible.
I wrote him a letter when his son died. Eversole. I was so sad. The little guy was such a bright spot. Just exuberant, enthusiastic.
Yeah.
You know, I got to know him in the XFL.
Right.
I think his name was Teddy. What a sweet kid. But I sent Dick a letter, and I got the most heartwarming response.
Yeah.
Handwritten. He said, "Teddy really loves you, JR. You're always so nice to him. He always said, 'Where's JR at?' Because I would hang with him.
Sure.
Answer questions, I was kind of a big kid myself. So,
yeah.
But Dick was a good guy. Look, he's the president of NBC Sports.
Right.
He's in charge of the Olympics. You know, he put pro football, big hand in putting pro football on television and seeing it evolve.
Right. And he helped launch Saturday Night Live.
Yeah.
With
Lorne Michaels.
He and Lorne Michaels, absolutely. So a major player.
So not a bad role model, quite frankly.
No, when at WrestleMania 5, one of the two WrestleManias I worked, when I was doing Coliseum videos, we had to get the video of the event out immediately. So this was the Trump Plaza in Atlantic City, and the thing was me and Okerlund and Kevin Dunn and Dick Eversole, we're going to, right after the show was over, we're going to take a private plane into Stanford or in New York. I don't know where we're going to go. So we're driving after the show, and the limousine driver gets to the airport, and the plane's not there. And so Eversole says, "You need to take us, then you need to drive us up to New York."
Wow.
And the limousine driver said, "Okay." And then the limousine driver started going back to Atlantic City. And Dick Eversole said, he pounded on that Monday. The window came down. He said, "Where are you going?" He said, "Well, my boss told me to go back to Atlantic City." He said, "Absolutely not. You turn around and you take us to New York." I mean, he was just giving him shit. And we drove to New York. It was like 3 hours that night. And I went, we dropped him off. He was living in the Trump Towers in the city. And we went into Stanford and dropped us off. And I had an editor there with me in the edit bay, and produced the home video overnight in my tux. Didn't even take my tux off all night doing that. And man, that had the creative juices flowing. That was good stuff, man. That's why I enjoyed my time there. But so when did they? So you were you there when they started completely scripting everything?
It's a system built for failure. It's like being creatively neutered.
Sure.
We don't need you to say your lines.
Yeah.
We don't want you to say what you feel.
Yeah.
We want you to memorize and recite what we write for you. Because we know what's best for you. You don't know what's best for you. Our writers who just got out of college are still pimply-faced little 20-something-year-old kids.
Yeah.
They know what's best for you. It isn't really an indictment on those that were writing the promos by any stretch. It simply was a system that was not efficient. Look, I bet there's a lot of fans will say, "Well, what really got me turned on to pro wrestling when I was younger were the promos. Those guys come out talking and they're entertaining and bigger than life.
That was it, man.
Well, they were creating their own content.
That was it.
I think that's what helps with AEW. One of the things, anyway, is that the talents are able to come and
do their shit.
And work through Tony Khan and create their own content.
Yeah. And you and I can do that too.
Oh, yeah.
You and I can. I mean, Tony will tell me at times to say things, you know, like, make sure you promote this or like shop AEW or something like that and give me some lines. But mostly he just lets us do our shit.
He does.
And that's one of the things I love about it. Just let JR be JR, right?
Whatever that's worth. That's what you hired.
That's exactly what you hired for.
So it's a lot better than being overproduced. Where those scripted promos in WWE came, the heavy-handed producing.
Yeah.
And boy, that was so poorly conceived.
Yeah.
It just led to everything that was not good about being a talent in a live show.
Yeah.
You just can't do it. And I got so many friends. You know, Sean Grandy, the voice of the Celtics.
Right.
My good friend, Brad Messler.
Oh, yeah.
Doing football, basketball. They've heard these stories about how McMahon produced talent. And they shake their head in amazement. How could they, you know, it's like, it sounded like I was just getting a practical joke played on me, but how hard they produced everybody. You know, that's, he drove Taz to the breaking point. He drove Mick Foley to the breaking point.
Yeah.
Now the other side of the coin is, from the McMahon camp, well, they got a man up. That's the way it is. Well, it is the way it is, but it is a good way.
Yeah. You cannot get the best out of you. In any work, this is what I'm thinking. Any job that you have, you cannot do your job correctly if your boss is hammering you all the time.
Right.
You can't do that. I couldn't have done it. I would have folded mid-show. I can tell you. I know how I am. I would have said, fuck it. I don't need this shit.